how to make people desire your presence. Why do some people instantly like us while others seem to be offended by our very existence? Is hitting it off and becoming friends with people purely a roll of the dice? Or is there something more we can do to control our chances of connecting with people? For many people, likability does seem to be a game of chance. If you happen to sit next to someone who is similar to you, and who also happens to share a hobby or hometown, then you'll have something to connect over. But statistically, that can't happen with every new friend we make, so things aren't quite adding up. As we saw from Little Albert and Pavlov's dog, we're more influenceable than we might assume. People who see likability as completely organic and natural are somewhat misguided because cultivating a feeling of likability around yourself is just like any other emotion. It can be triggered, summoned, eliminated, and ultimately engineered. If we want to make someone angry with us, we certainly know what to do and how to adjust our behavior. If we want to make someone cry, we also know how to create that feeling. Likeability is not much different. We push psychological buttons, but for a far more desirable outcome. We all have specific and subtle triggers that influence the way we view others and how they view us. Most of them are minuscule, subconscious, and mired in the minutiae. But these are the details that actually make the difference. If you went into a restaurant and saw only one cockroach hiding in the corner, well, it might be minuscule, but still quite important. The first chapter of the book focuses on the small details that comprise our first impressions, an integral part of likability. First impressions run deep, are not subject to change, and are your first opportunity to be likable, so this is as good a place to start as any. Context-dependent memories. Memories have long been found to be context-dependent, first by Godden and Badley in 1975 in their breakthrough publication, Context-Dependent Memory in Two Natural Environments, On Land and Underwater, which means memories are heavily linked to the environment, events, sounds, feelings, and even smells that were present during the formation of the memory. The researchers found that either being on land or underwater led subjects to recall different sets of memories. We can see this in our everyday lives. For instance, this is why so many of us fall into bouts of nostalgia when we hear certain songs. The song is information that is linked to much more than the song itself. This is why smelling a whiff of a buttercream pie takes us back to our grandmother's homes when we were children. This means memory is not a flat representation of a set of events. It's a holistic, three-dimensional snapshot of everything that was happening at that exact moment in time. Whatever else you were experiencing at the time is linked to the memory and can be used to bring it back up. Our brains act like sponges, not focused lasers, and absorb both consciously and subconsciously. Obviously, we don't always realize this because, by nature, the subconscious is beyond our awareness. But you might recall the feeling when you walk into your old school and suddenly memories come flooding into your brain as if on cue. But in fact, a 1994 study by Eich, McCauley, and Ryan titled Mood-Dependent Memory for Events of the Personal Past found that memories were also mood-dependent. In other words, the mood we had when the memory was formed is also part of the memory. The information is in there somewhere, and Eich and his associates found that by appealing to those hidden aspects of memories allows you to influence people's moods for the better. The researchers created situations to put the participants in either good or bad moods. Then, the subjects were given neutral words and asked what type of memories the neutral words evoked. Participants who were in good moods typically recalled positive memories, while participants who were in bad moods typically recalled negative memories. And, of course, the subsequent memories recalled served to further increase the moods they were in. Misery and happiness both grew. Memory and mood are closely linked, and influencing one can influence the other. In other words, if we think about happy memories, our mood rises, and if we think about dreadful memories, our mood plummets. By itself, it's not a huge revelation. If you think about puppies and kittens racing toward a bowl of food, you're likely to smile and laugh and get cheered up. But never before had it been shown that our moods can be so intimately tied to memories. It also works in reverse. Thus, if we can conjure up memories from a mood, we can use memories to conjure up a mood. And remember that memories are both explicit and subconscious. By understanding this relationship, we can sneakily become more likable. We can't control people's moods directly, but we can control the memories that they're thinking about to do it indirectly. This is the first step in becoming a presence that people start to crave. If you either 1. Directly talk about positive memories, or 2. Indirectly evoke elements that were present at the time of that positive memory, recall how holistic and three-dimensional memory is, people will slip into the mood they were in during that memory. For instance, suppose you know your friend Dorothy's happiest moment in life was when she got married to her beloved Beau Bryan. Her wedding was in a garden with lots of balloons, pillows, and flowers. She had a themed wedding where everyone wore black and silver as a tribute to her favorite band, Kiss. Presumably, she was in a good mood that day. So, what would you do to improve Dorothy's mood? You could, of course, mention her wedding and talk about how amazing it was and how beautiful she looked, but that's something you already know and don't need research to teach you. Instead of that, you could indirectly display or reference things that would remind her of that day. You might play Kiss music in the background. You might talk to her outside in a garden, and you might wear a black and silver shirt. You might even bring up a wedding you were at recently, since she's such a fond memory of weddings. Maybe none of these things in isolation would impact Dorothy's mood, but taken together, these are powerful indirect reminders and cues for one of her best memories. She'll pick up on that, and her mood will perk up, though she may not understand why. One more time for posterity, because our memories comprise everything our five senses can absorb, including our moods, directly or indirectly referencing that memory can lead to an improvement in mood. How can we wield this information? If you get a hint that someone is in need of a mood boost, you can talk about things, people, and events that were present when they were in fabulous moods. Reference their greatest triumphs or fondest memories. If you want to amplify someone's good mood to elation, then do the same thing. Talk to people in terms of what makes them happy, and it will make them happier. It's not a radical notion, and you don't necessarily need a scientific study to demonstrate this commonsensical approach. But now you know why it works, which allows you to be more intentional about it. For instance, if we want to improve someone's mood, our first inclination might be to simply make a joke, or create a distraction like an entire pizza and quart of ice cream. Those approaches are attempting to distract from the poor mood, while referencing memories is a direct means of changing it. Take advantage of your knowledge of someone and pull them out of the doldrums by triggering their greatest hits. If you know James had a blast the last time he went skiing, bring up a story he's told about it. Become his cheerleader. Have him retell it to you. Ask him about the logistics and whether or not he would remember that particular ski lodge. Talk about the games he played that weekend. Casually reference a video of skiing tricks. Likewise, if James loved biking, you could mention his greatest biking adventure, his longest ride, his favorite bike, his biking buddies, or his latest gear purchase. It makes sense that people like to discuss their favorite topics. But now there's a deeper psychological understanding of why and what it does to someone. Like Pavlov's dog, this isn't a process that we're fully aware of until we reach the end result of suddenly salivating. Ike's study was about influencing people's moods, not necessarily improving them. In the context of likability, the only way you should be influencing people's moods is positively, but this subconscious superpower can be used to take people's moods in any direction you wish. It just won't necessarily give you a pleasant outcome and subsequent association. No one's drawn to the person that reminds them of the last funeral they went to. The power of association. There's an additional benefit to improving someone's mood repeatedly, the power of association. If you play your cards right, people will subconsciously start associating their happy moods with you. You become part of their pleasant memory, and they begin to be drawn to you without a conscious understanding of why. When you're successful in creating a happy mood or dragging someone out of the dumps consistently, they'll begin to associate you with those positive feelings. As you'll discover, one of the running themes of this book is that human beings may appear complex and nuanced, but often we make choices that are incredibly straightforward and predictable. For instance, we will almost always make the decision to avoid pain and seek pleasure. You can come up with many theories about the motivations people have for certain things, but it's a very streamlined decision-making process the vast majority of the time. So we tend to gravitate toward people who make us feel good and away from things that hurt us. We also gravitate toward people and things associated with the people who make us feel good, and this is called classical conditioning. Remember Pavlov's dog? He would salivate in the presence of positive reinforcement and eventually was conditioned to salivate to only the sound of a bell. Byrne and Clore in 1970, with their reward-need-satisfaction theory, expanded on Pavlov's findings and discovered that if people are nearby when we feel good, even if they were not involved in creating the positive feelings, eventually we begin to feel good whenever they are around. When people subconsciously begin to associate you with positive moods and emotions, you're going to be the bell that makes people smile without realizing why. Creating or being present during people's great moods is one way to become associated with their happiness and for them to want you around. It's like if you're a baker and you need a rare kind of flour for your favorite cake. If you see the rare flour, you know you're going to have a chance to bake your favorite cake. It's not about the flower, and it's not about you. It's what you represent and are associated with.
This has been The Science of Likeability, 60 evidence-based methods to radiate charisma, make a powerful impression, win friends, and trigger attraction. Written by Patrick King, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2019 by Patrick King. Production copyright by Patrick King.